So we have survived to the last day. I think when do real people come to start teaching real things?
Huh?
Pedro's pretty real, yeah. I see. Oh wow! Great. Awesome. Great. So you're going to start doing real stuff. With real people. what I wanted to do today was having... having completed our whirlwind tour of all of physics and brought us up to the modern epoch, I wanted to tell you in a little more detail what some of these... about the main open problems. That are out there. But perhaps before we do that, maybe I should pause since yesterday went fairly late. And actually, just in general, before we move on to conquering the unknown, are there any general questions or things related to some of the topics that have come up previously that you want to discuss again? Maybe I'll just throw the floor open for some open discussion for a bit. Anything? Yes.
The probability in quantum mechanics being like really tough, the operator that counts to the times. I don't understand how you.
Well, that was an exercise.
Yeah.
But do you want to know what the statement is again, or do you want me to do
no,
the exercise?
No, I'll just tackle the exercise.
Oh. Tackling the exercise is not that hard. So the statement was that if you look at a state that's like alpha up plus beta down, but if you take n copies of it, then what you want to see, so this is like, roughly speaking, sum of the k, n choose k, alpha to the k, beta to the n minus k, times a state that would have, so you should know what I mean by this, k ups and n minus k downs. Right? Okay. So, so let's say you look at the n up over n acting on this state. Okay, so n up over n acting on this state is the sum over k and juice k. And up would, in the sum would be k. So k over n, alpha to the k, beta to the n minus k, up to the k, down to the n minus k. And the point is, the point is very simple. The point is that at large n, n choose k, alpha to the k, beta to the n minus k, becomes more and more peaked around a certain value of k. All right? I mean, this is really the a simple statistical point. Okay? The binomial distribution here, as n goes to infinity, n choose k, alpha to the k, beta to the n minus k, becomes very, very peaked around the value of k, where k is equal to what? Where k is equal to... alpha mod squared over n, where k over n is equal to alpha mod squared, and where n minus k over n is equal to beta mod squared. That's the non-trivial thing that you have to check. Okay, so the statement is about this binomial distribution. So if you look at n choose k, alpha to the k, beta to the n minus k, becomes more and more sharply peaked around the value of k, which is alpha mod squared over n is alpha mod squared. Okay? So this is a little exercise you have to do. Check. And if you remember some exercises you do in early on in statistical mechanics courses, they have a very similar flavor. Use the Stirling approximation, blah blah blah, and you find that this statement is true. So once that statement is true, that's just basically telling you that at large n, there are all these states there, but the biggest part of the state vector is being dominated by the place where k over n is of order alpha mod squared. So everything is fine. Another way of saying this is the following. That's really the most direct way. That's the most direct way of seeing it. You can, in general, say that let's say you have a bunch of spins, this is another feature of exactly the same point. Let's say you have a bunch of spins, Si, okay, and there's an x, y, z component for all of them. And again, it's some very quantum mechanical, it's quantum mechanical, so let's say it's even spin a half. So, whatever spin it is, the commutator of the spin operator for particle I, x and y, is Si, z, right? And plus the other two. So, this commutation relation, the fact that it's non-zero on the right-hand side, is telling you all the usual quantum mechanical things. You can't know the x and y at the same time, et cetera, et cetera. But let's say you define for n particles, let's say you define an average spin operator, S average, which is the sum over all I of Si for all the components. Let's call it S average. Okay. Then over n. Then you see that this S average starts looking more and more classical as n goes to infinity. Okay. If I look at the commutator of S average x, S average y, well, this is equal to 1 over n squared. Okay, there's a 1 over n squared. And then I get, because the commutator of the spins vanishes for different Si and Sj commute when I is not equal to j for different spins, I only pick up the contribution here from the sum over all I Szi. Okay? But then you see this is 1 over n times S average z. It's exactly the same phenomenon. This is actually the same basic statistical phenomenon over and over again. When you have n copies, when you do the experiment n times on a system with n degrees of freedom, n independent degrees of freedom, then the average quantum operators start to become commuting with each other in the n goes to infinity limit. And that's why you can know everything about them. Okay? But you've got to talk about the average quantities, not the individual ones. Yes. Yes.
The original statement said that the half square is like the eigenvalue of that operator at that state. Like if you are saying that the distribution is very big,
yes.
So I think that we only get the contribution when we have n of the half square times.
Yeah. So because the distribution is getting so peaked, then the only states that contribute as n goes to infinity, I mean, all the other states are there, okay? But it's becoming, but the wave function is picking up more and more support on the ones where you have alpha mod squared of the spin. Therefore, whatever the heck you act on it, for the n-op operator will measure alpha mod squared of the spins. That's a, this Stirling thing is a kind of a, is a very formal, fancy way of, it's not that fancy, but it's a formal way of seeing that that's true. But this is the basic phenomenon that I just, I just wrote down, right? These average quantities start behaving classical in, but you have to take n goes to infinity. Now you actually learn a little something extra from this, other than simply that the n goes to infinity limit gives you the probability. You also learn something about how the n goes to infinity limit is approached. What kind of deviation would you expect? What size fluctuation would you expect from this average answer? And the answer is it goes like 1 over square root of n. Okay, so that's another, it's a standard bit of statistics that as n becomes large, the width, this distribution starts looking like a Gaussian, peaked around the value where k over n is alpha mod squared. But the width of the distribution starts going like 1 over root n as n goes to infinity. So that's one of the standard rules of thumb you should always remember. Statistical fluctuations go like square root of 1 over square root of the number of trials. And that's what I said. When experimentalists, especially, as I said, particle experimentalists, because here quantum mechanics hits you all the time, because you collide two particles in something exactly the same way every time, and different things come out because of quantum mechanics. Okay, so if you see something, if you're putting, right, whatever measurement you're making, there's some irreducible statistical error having to do with how many trials you had, how many times you did the experiment. It goes like 1 over square root of n. And it's just an inevitable part of every talk any experimentalist gives reporting their results. You have to ask what the statistical error is. And it's interesting that fundamentally, the statistical error is sitting there, especially in simple experiments. You collide things identically every time. Different things come out. That's just a direct reflection of quantum mechanics. Okay, so it's and that square root of n, if you want to reduce the statistical error by a factor of 9, you have by a factor of 3, you have to do the experiment with 9 times more data. That square root of n sucks a little bit, but it's just like. Anything else? Yes.
So you say space-time is doomed.
Yes.
And particles rule. That's the right way to think of it.
Right.
But you define particles as irreducible representations of the symmetry group of space-time.
Right. Oh, very good.
Is that anywhere circular, or is that?
No, it isn't actually. Sorry. This is very important. Local space-time is doomed, but you see, the symmetries, the Lorentz transformation. Yeah, so let me be more specific. Yeah, this is a great opportunity for me to say a few things that I should have said before. Thanks for reminding me. So when I say space-time is doomed, we'll talk about it a little more. But what I mean is the idea of any local measurement, the idea of local physics in space-time cannot be correct. For some of the reasons we alluded to before, and we'll talk about in more detail. Now, that does not mean that the symmetries that we discovered by thinking about space-time are gone. In fact, quite the contrary. It's extremely likely that Lorentz transformations or Lorentz invariance is an exact property of, well, let's ignore cosmology for a moment. Okay, so imagine that we are living in some big flat Minkowski space. In a big flat Minkowski space, it would still be true that because of the reasons that I alluded to, and which we'll talk about again, that local space-time physics doesn't make isn't fundamentally there. Okay, local space-time physics is an approximation, but Lorentz transformations would be an exact symmetry. In this hypothetical world. The reason is that Lorentz transformations actually don't need to make any reference to what's going on in the inside of the space-time. I can define Lorentz transformations. So the sort of Actually, you know what? Let me start from the beginning of this discussion, because I was going to do it anyway. and then I'll get to your question. But it's a very important point, because some people think the idea that space-time can't be there fundamentally means, as I mentioned the first day, there's some kind of discreteness at short distances in space-time, which is a terrible and very silly idea. And one of the reasons it's this terrible and silly idea is it flies completely in the face of Lorentz invariance. The point is that it's possible to have Lorentz invariance without having fundamentally space-time. And the point is, as we'll just now say, that because of quantum mechanics and gravity, there is something more detailed simply than that space-time isn't there. It tells you something about what the observables of the theory are. And the observables of the theory end up involving problems that you can set up and measure at infinity at the boundary of the space-time. So not the inside of the space-time, but the boundary of the space-time. And Lorentz transformations are well-defined things, even on the boundary of the space-time. So it's very likely that Lorentz transformations are exact, even though the inside of the space-time isn't there. So let's actually go through this argument. So we saw this sort of qualitatively, that if you tried to do measurements at very short distances with very high energies, you'd collapse the region that you're trying to look at into a black hole. And we concluded from that you couldn't have that you couldn't do any measurements that would probe sub-Planckian distances. But there's something actually more. There's something more more refined than that we can actually say. So, and again, it just goes back to putting the words quantum mechanics and gravity together at the same time. Let's say you want to make any kind of local measurement, okay? Any sort of local measurement at all, like the temperature in this room. That's a local measurement. So let's say you're bounding the region you want to do the measurement in here. So let's imagine what we'd have to do to measure, as I said, any quantity at all. Well, I built some apparatus and I put it in the room. So here's my apparatus. Okay. What we're about to do here is it's a very simple argument, but I want to stress something about it ahead of time. When you're talking about anything in physics at the bottom, you first have to decide what it is that you're trying to predict, what it is that you're trying to calculate, what the actual observables are. Okay? First you decide what the observables are. Then once you know what could in principle be observable, you can come up with a theory that might predict it. Okay? But you don't put the cart before the horse and start, minimally you should know what it is that the output of the theory is supposed to be. Imagine there's some, again, there's an awful lot of fog out there about things related to quantum gravity. But there's very little actual fog, because there are in certain situations perfectly sharply defined questions you can in principle ask, and such that if someone handed you the answer, you would know it, okay? So that's the first thing to really try and decide. What are the things that you can in principle observe? And then what are the potential that should be the output of any putative theory that's going to compute it? But first you should figure out what it is that you're actually allowed to observe. Now, what is it that experimentalists actually do? Well, they make measurements. And they come back and they report the results of their measurements, and there's some error on those results. As we've discussed, sometimes the errors are systematic just because the experiment wasn't done as well as it could have been. Let's imagine that the experiments are done arbitrarily perfectly. There are certain irreducible sources of error. And the irreducible sources of error begin with quantum mechanics, just as we discussed. Okay? There are two things you have to do in a quantum world in order to reduce the error on whatever quantity you're reporting down to zero. First, You have to do the experiment infinitely many times. Okay? And secondly, and also very importantly, you have to do the experiment with an infinitely large apparatus. If you don't do the experiment infinitely many times, finitely many times with a finite size apparatus, there's an inevitable error in any result that you're going to report. Okay? Now, of course, those inevitable errors are there all the time in real life. But what we always imagine is that what the experimentalists are reporting is a quantity that we could, in principle, improve arbitrarily sharply. So if a theory predicts a number, you know, I mean, that any theory in the end of the day is going to predict some specific formula, some specific number. You have to ask what that specific number could possibly be referring to. And what it's referring to is what would happen in principle if the experimentalist did the experiment infinitely often with infinitely large apparatuses. Okay? Now, let's remember, the infinitely many times is to reduce the quantum mechanics is probabilistic, and it's to reduce that probability is to make the result, just as we were speaking, arbitrarily accurate. So literally, you know, you measure any quantity, you plot a histogram, okay? You do the experiment once, you get one value. You do it again, you get another value. As you start doing the same experiment infinitely many times, the histogram peaks and peaks and peaks and gets more and more peaked around an answer. Okay? So in principle, if you did it infinitely many times, it would give you just a completely sharp number. So the doing the experiment infinitely many times is because of quantum mechanics, and also having the apparatus be infinitely big is also because of quantum mechanics, because of the decoherence issue that we were talking about. Okay? If you don't have an infinitely large apparatus, then then you can't make this perfect separation between system and apparatus, and there's always these tiny off-diagonal terms in the density matrix. Only you first have to get those off-diagonal terms down to zero, then you do the experiment infinitely many times, and the diagonal entries become interpreted as the probability, give you the fraction of the time you measure spin up, fraction of the time you measure spin down, and so on. Typically, this second source of uncertainty is really, really, really small, which is why experimentalists never talk about it, right? Because already, apparatuses that are as big as our apparatuses, the amount of decoherence is already e to the negative 10 to the 30, right? Is incredibly, that's already in practice incredibly small. But still, you have to keep in mind, in principle, if you want to reduce the error to zero, you'd have to make the apparatus infinitely big. You'd have to make the Hilbert space of the apparatus infinitely big. Okay. And those two things are just because of quantum mechanics. That's the legacy of quantum mechanics on what we can talk about. The quantities that we can, in principle, talk about. The sharp quantities we can, in principle, talk about have to be are the result of experiments like that. Now, gravity in certain situations, gravity always makes one of these things impossible and sometimes makes both of them impossible. It always makes one of them impossible for certain sorts of questions, for local questions. So let's take it in turn. Let's first imagine a universe that's basically flat space. It isn't expanding. It's not doing anything funny. It's basically flat space. But I want to measure, as we are doing here, put some apparatus in a room and measure some aspect of any local property in the room, any local property I like. All right. Well, to do that, I have to do the experiment infinitely many times. That's okay. I have an infinite amount of time. Or I can do this in an infinitely many. I can set up something with infinitely many rooms of exactly the same sort. I have as much space as I want. Okay, the universe is infinitely big. So I can do the experiment infinitely many times. That's not a problem. But the problem is making the Hilbert space of the apparatus arbitrarily big. The reason is that for the Hilbert space of the apparatus to be arbitrarily big, I have to have many individual degrees of freedom, right? Let's say I want to make it out of spin a half particles. Okay, then I have one spin a half particle, two, three, four. I'm increasing the number of degrees of freedom. But every degree of freedom has some mass, right? Every degree of freedom has some mass. So by the time you start sending the number of degrees of freedom in here, by the time it starts getting gargantuan, okay, in practice it's gargantuan, but it's still some finite number, what starts happening is you can no longer ignore the mass of the apparatus. And there gets to be so much mass in the apparatus that what happens? You collapse the whole region that you're trying to study the physics in into a black hole again. You might say, that would happen if I make my apparatus out of massive particles. Can I make my apparatus somehow out of massless particles? Okay, you can try to make your apparatus out of massless particles, but you run into the same problem, because you're trying to keep the apparatus contained in this region. That means that there's a minimum wavelength to any particle. That minimum wavelength has a minimum energy, and off you go again. Okay, even if you try to make it out of massless particles, if you make enough of them, as you start making the apparatus bigger and bigger, you run into difficulties. When does this happen? Well, it turns out it turns out that the maximum number of degrees of freedom that you can have inside a volume of the maximum size of the Hilbert space. You can have inside a given region of size R, you might very naively think that the maximum number of degrees of freedom goes like e to the power, would scale like e to the power of the volume, right? You put little cells in there. You might imagine in each cell there's some finite number of degrees of freedom, and so therefore, the number of degrees of freedom would be exponentially large in the volume of the system. Okay? But the right answer ends up being that the total number of degrees of freedom is actually bounded by e to the negative the area in Planck units. This is also the entropy of a black hole whose size is R. Okay. I might explain this more in a second, but suffice it to say that this then puts, so it's a gravitational problem, but it tells you that if you're trying to do a measurement in a system of size R, if you're trying to do any local measurement in a region of size R, there's an completely irreducible, systematic uncertainty due to the fact that you can't reduce the decoherence effects completely to zero, and any quantity that you measure has an irreducible uncertainty of order e to the negative the area of the region in which you're doing the experiment, bounding it in Planck units. Okay. So, you know, when we say as theorists, especially to our experimental friends, there's no space-time, there's no local physics and so on, to say, what the heck am I doing in my lab all the time? You know, the hell are you talking about? Of course there's local space-time. You say, yes, of course there is. You won't care about what we're about to tell you, but no matter how smart you are, no matter how hard you work, no matter what you do, there's no experiment you'll ever be able to do where you're getting a histogram, you're measuring something, temperature in the room, okay? I don't know what this is. This is the number of times you get a certain value for the temperature. Okay. So you do the experiment once or twice. You start getting a few times. You get a little histogram that looks like that. You start doing the experiment more and more often, and it gets more and more peaked. So this is the number of hits, I guess. You're measuring the temperature. This is you're just making a histogram of the value you got for the temperature. You tell them that there's no experiment they can ever do that will reduce that width. That width is bounded by e to the negative the entropy of the black hole that would swallow up the room. Is of order e to the negative area of the room in Planck units. Okay.
I think it's a question.
Yeah.
Could you not collapse into a black hole if you made, if you didn't make it too dense?
Well, that's what the problem is. You need to keep the apparatus localized within this volume. The simple act of keeping it localized within that volume gives you a minimum amount of energy, just by the uncertainty principle. It gives you a minimum amount of momentum of order 1 over r, and you can do anything you want. You can stack them on top of each other in any way you like. There's an inevitable increase in the amount of mass. In fact, this is thought to be, and there's a huge amount of evidence for it, a real upper bound on the size of the Hilbert space that you can possibly talk about inside a region of size R. It doesn't make any sense to talk about Hilbert spaces whose dimensions are larger than E to the area in Planck units. So there's lots and lots of little different kinds of clever things you can try to do, and you find every single one of them runs into some problem, and this really seems to be a universal bound. This is one statement of what's known as the holographic principle. The holographic principle says more. This is really a statement of what's known as the Bekenstein bound, that the total number of degrees of freedom inside the Hilbert space that would describe what's going on inside a region of size, inside some region, is bounded by the exponential of the area in Planck units. That's surprising, right? Because you might naively think, if you just think about what's going on at the Planck scales, there's some kind of discreteness, some sort of lattice, something like that, you would think that the size of the Hilbert space could be e to the volume in Planck units. You might think that, okay? But it isn't. It's bounded by e to the area in Planck units. And I'll give you a little bit of evidence for that in a second. Yes?
Just one question. How can the maximum number of degrees of freedom decrease with R? Because...
Oh, I'm sorry. There's a plus sign there. I was talking about the amount of decoherence is bounded by e to the negative. But yes, there's a plus sign in all of those. Yeah. There's a minus sign here. So the accuracy is bounded by 1 over the number of degrees of freedom of the Hilbert space of the apparatus. Yes?
If it's to do with the area rather than the volume, can you in theory have like a fractal area that is an infinite area with finite volume, in which case it's a problem?
No, because all of those fractalian things break down as you start talking about distances of order via Planck length. So you don't get... You don't get much mileage out of things like that. I'll explain why. I'll give you more evidence that that's true in a second. But actually, even if you thought it was naively e to the volume, it would still be some finite number. Okay. So. This tells us, now, we don't in principle care. I mean, we don't in practice care. That exponential is such a minuscule number, we don't in practice care. And also, if you're very naive, very naively, it looks like this exponential is only important. I mean, that's such a minuscule effect. You basically don't care unless you're talking about distances of order, the Planck length, okay? But even so, it tells us something important. I mean, it's like quantum mechanics. Most of the time, you don't care about quantum mechanics either, quantum effects either, okay? But there was a profound lesson in quantum mechanics that instead of talking about position and velocity, we have to talk about position or velocity, okay? So quantum mechanics took away things that we could predict. We had a deterministic world before, but quantum mechanics just puts a fundamental limitation on what we can actually sharply predict. And now, quantum mechanics combined with gravity seems to be taking that one step further. There's even fewer things that we can sharply predict. Okay. So the answer to the experimental colleague who asks, what the heck do you mean there's no local spacetime, is what I said, there just isn't a sharp number that any experiment they can do can return. And whenever that's happened to us before in physics, it has meant that the thing that we're talking about just isn't part of the more correct fundamental theory. Just like in quantum mechanics, position and momentum weren't part of the correct theory. It was position or momentum, and it involved this completely different this kinematical change in how we thought about physics. So what could we possibly predict then? So there's no such thing as local observables. Okay, no such thing as local observables. If anyone comes around and says, I have a theory of quantum gravity, the first question you should ask them is, okay, great, what does it predict? What are the observables? Not what does it predict, what experiment is going to prove that it's wrong and stuff like that. You know, that's way further down the line. Okay? So the first question to ask them is, what does it even in principle predict? And if they say it predicts this and that about this local observable and that and this, you should say, I'm sorry, that's nonsense. Okay? There's no local observables. So if your theory is talking about local things, it just can't be right. There's just this argument. Okay? There just ain't no local observables in any sensible theory that puts quantum mechanics and gravity together. So what can we do? There is one kind of observable which is left. We can make these apparatuses infinitely big, provided that we're not doing a local measurement. Okay? So what I can do is send particles in from infinity, have them scatter, and have them go back out to infinity. Okay? That's something I can do infinitely many times with arbitrarily large apparatuses because, you know, if you like, have an infinitely large apparatus per particle that you're scattering in. Okay? Just this guy's going out, have its own infinitely large apparatus privately to measure this guy. Whoa. Okay? Privately to measure that guy, privately to measure that guy. I can make the apparatuses infinitely big because the things are getting separated from each other as I go out to infinity. Okay? So that's something which is in principle perfectly well defined. This S matrix that we talked about yesterday, the S matrix is something, I mean, it's also something that most of the time we talk about in particle physics. We collide particles, they go in, they come out. And of course, in practice, they don't come in from infinity and go out to infinity. They go around a ring in Geneva, they bang into each other, they go out 30 meters into the detectors. But what we're measuring there, we think of as approximating something that could, in principle, be measured arbitrarily accurately. Okay? Particles coming in from infinity and going back out to infinity. So is it clear why that gets around this problem? Because I can make the apparatus infinitely big. And this infinitely big apparatus isn't disturbing the other one because that one's infinitely far away. Okay? There's just a nice limit I can take where the question is no longer a local question. Okay? The question is I send things in from infinity, I measure them at infinity. So it isn't a local question. But that is in principle a possible output. That's an in principle perfectly sharp observable. And that's what the output of theory of quantum mechanics and gravity, that's the only possible output it could have. Well, maybe there are other ones that we haven't been clever enough to think about, but it's definitely not these. And at least that S matrix is a possible output, is a possible observable, is something that could come out of theory of quantum gravity. Now, you see, now coming back to your question, that S matrix could be a perfectly Lorentz invariant quantity. Okay, we talked about it in a perfectly Lorentz invariant way. Lorentz transformations, nice global symmetries, act on all of the space-time. They also act on the boundary of the space-time. So we know what's going on. There's a well-defined notion of Lorentz transformations, even if we are no longer so sure about what's happening inside the bulk of the space-time. Okay. Now, this is an abstract argument. But it's a very powerful general lesson that in a theory of gravity, the observables are associated with the boundary of space-time, and not the inside of space-time. The inside of space-time doesn't really fundamentally exist. The boundary of space-time exists. The inside doesn't exist. Yes.
In a curved space-time, what do you mean by Lorentz transformation?
Okay, very good. So as I said, this whole situation we're talking about we are talking about a situation where the space-time is asymptotically flat. So you can imagine, and the inside it's curved. Okay, you can imagine that I throw in a bunch of gravitons, they collide, they make a nice curved space-time in the middle, lots of things happen, they make a black hole, all sorts of cool stuff can happen. But at minus infinity, it's flat. At plus infinity, it's flat. In that situation, Lorentz transformations are perfectly well-defined things. Okay, so, yeah.
Like
absolutely. So let's come to those. Okay. So this powerful lesson is telling you that it apparently only makes sense to talk about any observables associated with quantum gravity, because of quantum mechanics and gravity, all the observables live on the boundary of the space time. So let's first talk about the situation where those boundaries exist. Then we'll move to the more confusing situations where it's not clear that any such boundary exists. Okay. So one situation is asymptotically flat space, where this observable is the S matrix. Something wonderful that happened 13 years ago is the realization that there was an example that wasn't as close to the real world as approximately flat space, but was still but was more mathematically tractable, which is to think about a negatively curved space. Anti-de Sitter space. Okay. So this is space-time with negative curvature. and in some set of coordinates, well, I can talk about it I'll talk about it in more detail in a second, but just to make the qualitative argument. It's a negatively curved space. It has a boundary, so here's time. There's a way of talking about it where it's where it's negatively curved. It has a boundary. The boundary is at the infinite distance away, even though it takes light a finite amount of time to get there. Okay. But there is a nice boundary. And on this boundary, you know, time flows forward just like time flows in the interior. Okay? So there's a well-defined boundary where you could imagine sort of standard ordinary physics. The boundary of Minkowski space is a little bit of a funny place. When I say the boundary of Minkowski space, I don't mean spatial infinity. I mean the boundary where sort of ultimately light rays can go, directed towards the future. So the boundary of Minkowski space is a null surface. Okay? And thinking about physics on that null surface is less familiar. But in anti-de Sitter space, the boundary is just, for example, in five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, the boundary of this five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space is just ordinary Minkowski space, four-dimensional Minkowski space. And you can ask one more time, because though we can move things arbitrarily far apart, we can make apparatuses infinitely heavy, all of that stuff. There's analogs of this scattering particles together, and that, well, it's basically the same thing. You except now it's an anti-de Sitter space, so you move, you can excite gravitons, you can excite whatever things there are around at the boundary. They propagate into the interior of the space, they interact with each other, they come back out, and you can measure how that happens. Okay? And now you can measure how that happens in lots and lots of ways, because at the boundary here at one time t1, you can, some other time t2, you could throw things in, and they can come back out, measure it here at some time t3, and measured there up at some time t4, and at various positions, x1, x2, x3, x4. So there's a whole rich zoo of things that you can measure. These rich zoo of things are called boundary correlation functions. Okay? So you can throw things in at different positions and times, measure them out at different positions of times on the boundary. And these are quantities that could be the putative output of a theory of quantum gravity. They're the exact observables, and they're the putative output as well. Okay? So exactly the same logic, precisely the same logic. There's no meaning to the inside of the space. There's no meaning to the inside of the space-time. All the observables are associated with the outside, with what's going on at the boundary. So this basic insight that the only observables associated with gravity, with quantum gravity, live on the boundary, goes back to people like Bryce DeWitt in the 1960s. I mean, it's a very deep and very, very important fact, but it's also an old fact. The marvelous thing that happened in string theory 13 years ago is the realization that not only are the observables associated with something that lives on the boundary, but associated with that, the theory that calculates those observables, the theory of quantum gravity that whose output are those is those observables, is actually a theory that lives on the boundary itself. So, in other words, the theory that describes everything that can happen inside the bulk of this ADS space, everything. And that everything can be a huge number of stuff. This ADS space can be arbitrarily weakly negatively curved, okay? Incredibly weakly negatively curved. So if you were inside, you would hardly notice the curvature. If you lived inside this space, you would, if you're small enough, you would think it's a nice flat space. You would have all the same confusing questions about quantum gravity. You would still think that you try to measure short distances, you collapse things into a black hole. You would still wonder almost all the questions that short distance questions we ask about quantum mechanics and gravity are identical in this toy world to our world. Okay? So there's an enormous number of questions you can set up. You can collide particles, make a black hole, and wonder what happens as a black hole evaporates. Okay? You can ask all the same sorts of questions. But in this case, we know the answer now. We know what the fundamental theory is. And the very remarkable answer is that the theory that describes everything about what's going on in here, which are encoded in all these boundary correlation functions, because these are the only sharp observables, okay? That theory is just a good old-fashioned four-dimensional quantum field theory. Okay. A four-dimensional quantum field theory. Now, in that four-dimensional quantum field theory, the field theory has all sorts of local observables that we could talk about. In a field theory, I could excite something here and then measure what happens there, and then measure what happens there, and so on. Okay? So it's this four-dimensional field theory doesn't even see the inside of this five-dimensional space. Just lives in four dimensions. You can think of it as being the boundary of this five-dimensional space, or you can just think of it ab initio, just a four-dimensional field theory. This four-dimensional field theory is a hell of a lot like the standard model of particle physics. It's just a good old-fashioned Yang-Mills theory of exactly the sort that I was telling you about yesterday. It has an interesting feature, of course. The strength of the interactions in this Yang-Mills theory isn't weak. It's very, very strong. Okay? But you can actually continuously interpolate it from weak to strong. So there's no phase transitions. Nothing crazy happens. It would start off something, if the couplings were weak, you'd just have a bunch of gluons, quarks and gluons, just like the theories that we know and love in nature, the Yang-Mills theories I was talking about. Then you make the coupling stronger and stronger and stronger. The interactions start becoming really, really strong. And then you find when the interactions become extremely strong, and the limit where you make the interactions very, very strong, that if you do any measurement in this four-dimensional theory, any measurement at all, that the answers are computing the physics that's happening inside this five-dimensional space with gravity. Actually, it's a whole 10-dimensional string theory. So it has this five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space as well as five compact dimensions on a sphere. And it has everything in it, gravity, strings, black holes, all of this stuff is just a feature of the dynamics and interactions of this four-dimensional quantum theory. So this is a great, I think, I think it's certainly the greatest thing that has happened in theoretical physics in the last certainly that I've seen in my career, probably in the last 20 or 30 years. And it's a great testament. It's a great testament to like asking sharp questions, following your nose, asking sharp questions, and not getting too bogged down in fog and philosophy. Okay, you pursue the question: what can you possibly measure? What can you possibly talk about? The answer is things that live on the boundary. Okay, and then really the bold leap from there is there. If the only possible things you can measure live on the boundary, maybe there's just no inside at all. Maybe there's just a theory that just lives on the boundary. And it's the consequence of the dynamics of that theory in some approximation that makes it seem as if there is the inside of the space. That ends up being the right answer. Okay? You see, this is why I say the idea of atoms of space-time is amazingly naive. Okay? This is what the answer could look like, completely compatible with all the basic principles that we know. And it's a much more surprising kind of answer than this most naive picture that things just become discrete at short distances. You can just say the words, things become discrete at short distances, and it leaves you with nothing to do. What are you supposed to talk about? What's the output of the theory? What is it supposed to measure? Okay, all the measurements are living at the boundary. What's remarkable is not only that all the measurements live at the boundary, but there are theories on the boundary that compute them. So, and the way this works, you'll have, I'm sure, a whole lecture series on this. What's called the ADS-CFT correspondence, but really should more probably be called the quantum field theory quantum gravity correspondence. Okay, that's really what it's saying. That quantum field theory in lower dimensions is the same as quantum gravity in higher dimensions. Quantum gravity in higher dimensions, at least in these situations where there's negative curvature. Okay? So this development should really convince you that the set of questions that have to do with the short distance structure of quantum gravity is a solved problem. You can always imagine anything you're talking about. Now, very interesting, our universe is not like that. Our universe has a slightly positive curvature. It's cosmology. It's accelerating and expanding. And that means that we cannot directly apply this argument fundamentally to talk about what quantum mechanics and gravity look like completely in our universe. However, but you should be careful to distinguish what are the sorts of questions that we can't address. The sorts of questions that we can't address have nothing to do with what people used to think of as the hard part of quantum gravity. It has nothing to do with what happens when you collide particles at Planckian energies. Is there something mysterious going on? Nope. That's the sort of question that has a beautiful answer in the ADS-CFT correspondence. It has nothing to do with when you make black holes, do they evaporate? Does information, is it lost? Does it come back out? The answer is the information comes back out. ADS-CFT has solved that problem, full stop. There are the questions that are left that are confusing have to do with cosmology, have to do with the fact that our universe is accelerating, and have to do with the confusions of how we talk about observables in this cosmological context now. Okay, so you shouldn't be confused about where the nub of the issue is. Just because our universe doesn't have negative curvature doesn't mean that, by the way, there's no proofs of the statements that I'm giving you. Okay. But physics is about finding truth. You can prove them much, much, much later. But we have finite lives, and it's very important to like have some idea of what you think is true if you're going to be spending your time on it. So I'm telling you the things that I'm almost certain are true. There's no like, you know, fully sharp proof of any of these things. But I would say I would find it very, very shocking if in our universe with a slightly positive curvature, with a curvature scale of 10 billion years, the answer to the question of what happens when you make a little 10 centimeter sized black hole actually cares that much, whether the universe has a positive curvature of 10 billion years, 10 billion light years, or had a negative curvature of 10 billion light years. If it had a negative curvature of 10 billion light years, we would be done. In that universe, there would be a dual description in terms of some kind of lower dimensional quantum field theory, and the problem of what happens when you make a black hole, how the information does the information come out, and so on, would just have a beautiful answer. Everything would be fine and is fully understood. Okay, now so that's what I'm saying. The mysteries that are left, the really deep mysteries that are left, have to do with the fact that the curvature is positive, and that this very basic logic for what the observables are fundamentally changes again. Okay? So let me actually start talking about that aspect of things. Actually, before doing that, let me give you a little bit more of an idea why it is that the number of degrees of freedom inside a system of volume V doesn't scale like e to the V. So this sounds surprising at first, but let's get a feeling about it. So let's say you have some system of size R, and let's count how many states there are inside the Hilbert space, inside that volume. Okay? Well, first there's a ground state. So there's one state. Okay? Next, I have a whole bunch of one particle states, right? So how many one particle states are there? Well, I have one particle states whose momenta are quantized in units of 1 over r, right? So I have one particle states of momentum 1 over r, 2 over r, 3 over r, and so on, right? Now, in principle, this goes all the way up to infinity, right? I have arbitrarily short distance, arbitrarily short wavelength modes, arbitrarily high momentum, arbitrarily high k. We know that something funny is going to happen around the Planck length, though, so we shouldn't count things that are much higher than the Planck length. For the moment, let's just put some kind of ultraviolet cutoff of some sort. Let's just call it lambda UV. Okay. So I should only count things up to when n max over r is comparable to lambda UV. So n max is around lambda UV r. Okay. So how many one particle states are there then? Well, it's of order n max cubed, right? It's a three-dimensional space, so I have this 1 over r, 2 over r, 3 over r. I can have them in three directions. Okay? So the number of one particle states is of order lambda UV r cubed. How many two particle states are there? Well, it's just the square of this number. But they're identical, so I divide by 2 factorial. Okay. The number of three particle modes is lambda UV r cubed over 3 factorial, and so on. So if I just count all of the modes that are in there, I get a number which is e to the lambda UV r cubed. So that's the origin of the feeling that the number of degrees of freedom when we say number of degrees of freedom, loosely what we mean is the size of the Hilbert space is of order e to that number. So we'd say the number of degrees of freedom for a spin a half particle is 2, or for a spin a half particle is s. So things are so the total size of the Hilbert space is exponentially large in what we mean by the number of degrees of freedom. If you like, when I say number of degrees of freedom, always think about e to the n as being the dimensionality of the Hilbert space. Okay? So this is the origin of the statement that the number of degrees of freedom scales like the volume. That's the naive thought, that it scales like the volume. But we actually know that there's something wrong with this when gravity is taken into account. It's the same thing over and over again. Gravity adds up. Gravity is universal. And the problem is that here I'm making a tacit assumption. The tacit assumption is that these states are relatively weakly interacting with each other. So there are that many two-particle states. How do I know? Well, because the interactions are pretty weak, so if I put them on top of each other, I'm not going to just remove the state all of a sudden completely out of the Hilbert space. When the interactions were small, they were there. When I turn on little interactions, these states aren't just disappearing. Okay? But what happens as you go to big enough n is there are so much that I'm just trying to decide, do these states exist? Are they actually in the Hilbert space? I was deciding that they were in the Hilbert space by just imagining I could put the free ones on top of each other, right? But at some point, you have so many particles that I can't neglect the fact anymore that they're gravitating. In fact, those states would have so much energy that they would have collapsed the whole region into a black hole. That means at that point, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I mean, I've completely changed the problem. So let's actually, just for fun, let's count all the states that I can reliably count. Let's just count all the states that are not going to turn into a black hole. Okay? Let's just see how many of them we get. All right, well, in order for them not to turn into a black hole, I have to have that this UV cutoff depends on the number of particles. Okay? And I want to choose it such that if the particles had an energy that was that high, if n particles had an energy that was that high, that it wouldn't collapse, it will just have collapsed this region into a black hole. So that happens when n lambda UV, so this is the energy that they would have, g Newton, which is 1 over m Planck squared, this over R is comparable to 1. That means that I need to put a UV cutoff that depends on the number of particles, which is of order m Planck squared R over n. So you see what's going to end up happening. That as n gets really, 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 really big, I'm going to be counting fewer and fewer states reliably. Right? Because I have to put a lower and lower cutoff on them to make sure that that the guys aren't collapsing into a black hole. So let's go back to this formula. And, well, things are getting dominated at large n here. So at large n, the number of states that I would get go like 1 over n factorial, lambda UV, but now that depends on n r cubed to the power of n, right? So sum over n, something that looks like that. All right, but lambda uv of n, let's just put this let's put this expression in. Right. So lambda UV of n r, just from here, let's see, am I doing this right? Yes. Yep. Yeah. Oh, this is fine. So lambda UV of n r, notice, is m Planck squared r squared over n. Which m Planck squared r squared is also nothing other than the area in Planck units. Okay? So m Planck squared r squared is the area in Planck units, which would be what you would call the entropy of the black hole with that size. So let me just call it S black hole. Okay. So this is of order S black hole over n to the power of 3n. Sorry. It's just a word of S black hole over N. So the number of degrees of freedom, so that the size of the Hilbert space, the size of the Hilbert space is then becoming sum over N, 1 over N factorial, S black hole over N to the 3N. Okay, let's see if we can approximate this sum at large N. If we approximate this, just to see what N dominates this sum at, because S black hole is a big number, and Planck squared R squared is big for macroscopic region. So we just use Stirling's approximation. So N factorial, so let me just take the log. Okay. So the log of that term, the log of one of these terms, log of one of N factorial, S black hole over N to the 3N, this is 3N log S black hole over N minus log N factorial, which is around 3N log S black hole minus 3N log N from here. And then log N factorial is like N log N. Using Stirling, that log N factorial is about N log N minus N. I'm even ignoring the minus N. Okay. The important point is here that this is of order 3N log S black hole minus 4N log N. So this is getting dominated. This is getting dominated at around the N, such that at around N, which is log N, is of order 3/4 log S black hole. And if you just shove this back into that expression to get an estimate for how big the whole thing is, you get an estimate for the dimension of the size of the Hilbert space, which is then e to the 3/4, e to the S black hole to the 3/4. So this is log S black hole to the 3/4. And if you plug it back in, you get that dimensionality for the size of the Hilbert space. So you see this naive feeling that the number of degrees of freedom is growing like the volume. What's making it wrong is the fact that gravity is in long-range force, and it piles up, and it can eventually badly back-react on the region that you're looking at. What we've done here is just count the degrees of freedom that would make sense in this box that would not collapse a region into a black hole. And we see that that number is vastly smaller than e to the volume. It's even smaller than e to the area. Okay? It's going like e to the area to the power of 3/4. So this is way, way smaller, parametrically, way, way smaller than e to the black hole entropy itself. Now, we went through this counting exercise, but let me give you a more vivid illustration of exactly the same point, or more physical illustration of exactly the same point. Let's say you had a ball of gas. Let's say you had a ball of gas that had some temperature T and a radius R. And this ball of gas is so hot, it has a lot of energy, just relativistic particles, It's a lot of energy, and it's just about to collapse into a black hole. Just on the verge of collapsing to a black hole. So let's figure out what its entropy is, just as it's about to collapse into a black hole. All right? This is another nice dimensional analysis exercise. So these are just a gas of photons. Gas of photons with a temperature T, which is just about to collapse into a black hole. So first of all, what is the mass of that ball? I've given you a temperature, right? So what's the energy density in that gas of radiation? What are the units of energy density?
Energy of a volume.
Energy of a volume, so it's of order energy to the fourth, right? Here at the moment, the only data is the temperature and the radius, right? We're not talking about gravity yet. So the energy density is just a property of the of this like gas of hot gas of photons that's wandering around. So the only local property it has is the temperature. So what's the energy density? It's just T to the fourth. There's nothing else it can be. Okay. So the energy density is T to the fourth. So the mass is T to the fourth R cubed. And so if it's just on the verge of collapsing to a black hole, that means that m over m Planck squared r is of order 1. So that means that t to the fourth r cubed over r squared over m Planck squared is of order 1. Okay? So if I have a ball of gas with t and r which satisfy this relationship, it's just on the verge of collapsing to a black hole. Okay? On the other hand, what's the entropy? The total entropy of this ball of gas. Once again, what's the entropy density? What are the units of entropy density? The entropy itself is just a pure number. So entropy density is units 1 over volume. So the entropy density has units of mass to the fourth. So entropy density, which you could call sigma, is T cubed, is all it can be. So the total entropy is of order T cubed R. Okay. Okay, so let's work out what T cubed R is if T satisfies this relationship. See, if T satisfies this relationship, this is T to the T cubed R cubed. T cubed times the volume, right? Okay, well, let's just work it out. So we see from here, we see that T to the fourth R squared is then Planck squared. Let me actually make my life easier, multiply left and right by R squared to get T to the fourth R to the fourth is M Planck squared R squared. Which is the area in units of the Newton constant, which is the entropy of the black hole. So T to the fourth, R to the fourth is the entropy of the black hole, but the entropy of the gas of radiation is T cubed R cubed, which is the entropy of the black hole to the 3/4. Okay, that's the same 3/4 we saw a moment ago from our counting argument. So once again, when you have any normal degrees of freedom, standard gas of photons, things that we can count reliably, things where the gravitational effects aren't important, these two examples show you how hard it is, actually, to get even approach e to the area in Planck units. Okay? The object that has vastly, by far, the most degrees of freedom inside a region R is the black hole. Anything else has way fewer degrees of freedom. This is actually a nice consequence of the second law of thermodynamics as well. Let's say you had a region and it wasn't a black hole. Now start throwing things into it. Books, laundry, okay? Throw anything into it you want. At some point, it'll get enough mass to collapse a region into a black hole. So if the entropy goes up, which it should, then it had better be that the entropy that it started with is smaller than the ultimate entropy that it has, which is the area in units of the Newton constant. Okay? So these are many arguments to the same conclusion. It's actually hard to excite, to have too many degrees of freedom inside inside some volume. In fact, the vast majority of the degrees of freedom are not standard ones, are not ones that we can count easily. They're that, they're actually the degrees of freedom that would be excited if the whole thing was black. Okay? This is just stressing that this naive picture that the number of degrees of freedom goes like e to the volume isn't sort of deeply mysteriously wrong and everything you know is wrong. Quite the contrary. If you just sit and try to count the things that you can reliably count, you'll find that you can't even get as close as that. You can't even get as big as e to the area. It's always bounded by this e to the area to the 3/4 power. Okay. The fact that the entropy, that you should associate an entropy to the black hole of order of its area, the formula is actually A divided by 4 G Newton. That was guessed first in the early 70s from classical properties of black holes that Hawking and other people discovered, that remarkable classical properties that they had, that if you had one black hole and another black hole, and this first black hole had area A1 and the second black hole had area A2, if they came together, they would always make a third black hole whose area was strictly bigger than A1 plus A2. Okay? So at first, they looked like analogies, that it looked like the area of the black hole was analogous to entropy. It always went up when you combined black holes with each other. Then people started running into puzzles with thermodynamics because of the sort of things that I mentioned. You know, what if you take a nice hot ball of gas and throw it into a black hole? The things inside the black hole are causally disconnected with the things outside, so naively you're losing, you can lower the entropy in the universe. You can lower the entropy of the universe by dumping things into the black hole. Okay? But of course, at a slight cost, right? You make the black hole more massive and its area grows. So the suspicion arose that maybe you could actually assign and say that black holes had an entropy like any other entropy, but their entropy was proportional to their area somehow. Okay? That would at least begin to make it possible to save the second law of thermodynamics in the presence of black holes. But it had a severe problem, which was that if black holes have entropy, they should be hot. But classically, nothing escapes from a black hole. That's the whole point of what makes it black. And so there was a great deal of skepticism to this idea, even though it was completely correct. And Bekenstein said it very, very clearly. It's a completely correct idea. But there was skepticism because if it was true, black holes would have to be hot. They would have to radiate. And then, of course, Hawking did his famous calculation when he realized that they did radiate. They did radiate at precisely the temperature that allowed you to interpret their entropy to be the area as it needed to be. Okay? So this is another great example. As I say, things don't when things are in conflict in physics, it's not normally you just give up all the principles and you just call it a day. You keep going with the principles and they end up jamming together in a more remarkable way, in a more constrained way than before, not less. That's a glorious example of it. Okay? So that's how this formula, that the entropy of the black hole is its area over 4 G Newton, this formula ends up being true in any number of dimensions. And is one of the very deepest things about quantum mechanics and gravity that we know. But for the reasons that I said, this also implies that the number of degrees of freedom, or the size of the Hilbert space, the dimension of the Hilbert space inside a region of size R, inside a region is less than e to the area of the region in over 4 g newton. Okay. And pushing this to its logical conclusion is this idea of the holographic principle, which is that not only is all of this true, but the correct theory that describes what's going on inside a region lives on the boundary of the region. And as I said, the really sharp notions of holography, the ones that there's actually equations associated with, really go back to this even earlier observation that the only observables you can talk about, period, live at the infinite boundary of space-time. Okay? So that's also an early harbinger of exactly the same set of ideas. There's no inside of the volume. Things live on the boundaries. The number of degrees of freedom are bounded by areas, not volumes. All of these things go hand in hand to saying that the inside of the space-time doesn't exist fundamentally. But perhaps what lives at the boundary of the space-time does. Okay. What we're going to talk about when we come back is I will tell you a little bit about what the cosmological mysteries are. And then I will end by returning to the other set of questions associated with the fine-tuning problems and tell you a little bit about them, especially because those are the questions that are going to be immediately experimentally accessible in this decade. We shouldn't forget that there are some absolutely glorious experiments happening of the sort that happen once every generation, and you should really be thinking about them and seeing how you want to interact with them as well. All right.